Blog Talk Radio.
Our roots began in Africa, where we enjoyed self-determination and freedom, which were rooted in our sovereignty. Peace, family, welcome to Dare to Win, the Us Lifting Us weekly radio program that airs every Thursday evening from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Dare to Win is the place where we have sobering conversation about the economic plight of Black people and the imperative that we build the global economic machinery that will free us and once again put us on the path of making history. We at Us Lifting Us have developed an exact methodology on how to build this global machinery and pass it forward to our children and future generations. If you'd like to join tonight's conversation, please call 929-477-2789. Press the number 1 on your phone when you want to make a comment or ask a question. If you prefer to listen on your computer, go to www.usliftingus.com. Scroll down to the bottom of the homepage, click on the Dare to Win button, then click on Listen Live. At that time, you will be on the Blog Talk Radio site. If you want to get reminders from Blog Talk Radio for upcoming Dare to Win programs, click on the Follow button. Google members, we have our own social media community. Please join if you have not done so. There is a Dare to Win group, and we would like to have your feedback on past Dare to Win programs, as well as topic suggestions for future programs. Go to usliftingus.com. You can reach the Ulu community through the members-only portal. When you register for the Ulu community, please use the same name you used when you joined Ulu. hold the date for our 2024 ULU Convention and Annual Meeting, which will be held on Saturday, March 9th and Sunday, March 10th in Atlanta. This will be our first face-to-face meeting in a few years. Consider it a family reunion. Remember, this is for members only. Make sure your dues are up to date so you can attend. More information will be forthcoming. Those dates again, Saturday the 9th of March and Sunday the 10th of March, 2024. I'm Sister Q, and joining me for this evening's discussion is Brother Aunty, who, like me, is a member of ULU. Tonight's topic is what we're going to do, time to build an African economy. Peace, Brother Aunty. How are you doing tonight?
Greetings, Sister Q. I'm well. Good to hear your voice. Good to be with our family this evening. And I'm excited about what we're going to talk about tonight. So, yes, these are interesting times. And I hear the ancestors calling us to some particular work. So we'll talk about that as we get into tonight's program.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to tonight's program. It's good to have you back. So, Brother Aunty, how did you come? What brought you to tonight's topic?
Well, thank you, Sister Q. A couple of things have been weighing on my spirit heavily. And so just as a backdrop to what we'll talk about in the meat of the program tonight, or in the body of the program tonight, I think while there are many serious crises facing us or facing the human family, two stick out most recently, one being the continuing extermination, genocide, and slaughter against the people of Gaza. Now, that's not to make light of the travesty and the death and killing that's taking place on the continent of Africa, but I think the situation in Gaza is especially brutal. This outright murder of thousands of women, children, elderly, and infirm people by the Israeli military forces should be a critical reminder to all of us of who it is that we're dealing with. The Israelis, like their European cousins, even a shred of humanity when it comes to dealing with people they classify as non-white. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention what our sister, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, shared with us so many years ago, that racism, white supremacy, is a global system of domination and control whereby people who classify themselves as white dominate and control people they classify as non-white for the purpose of genetic survival. And we must understand very clearly that to see this level of brutality being exhibited against the people of Gaza lets us know that the crisis in capitalism is indeed acute. The second thing that has got me, that I've been watching and have been paying close attention to, is the hijacking of the COP28 Global Climate Conference that just concluded in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, by the fossil fuel industry. Now, we won't go into detail about this travesty tonight. For good background information, I would encourage our listeners to go to democracynow.org. They covered the conference each and every day and have a good analysis of what happened. The UN Conference on Climate Change concluded several years ago that we as a species have until 2030 to reduce fossil fuel use by 50% and eliminate fossil fuel use completely by 2040 if we are to avoid catastrophic extreme weather events. Well, thanks to the fossil fuel industry, we now are talking about 2050 as the date when we'll begin to phase out of fossil fuel use. So, you know, we see these severe weather events, the flooding, the hurricanes, the tornadoes. We know that the weather systems have been disrupted by global warming, and it's only going to get worse. The countries and the people that will be most severely impacted by these extreme weather events are in the global south. In other words, people at and below the equator, which is primarily peoples of color. And so mm-hmm. for the fossil fuel industry to once again push back any real attempts to reduce fossil fuel use and eliminate fossil fuel use back to 2050 simply says we know people are going to die, but our profits are more important than the lives of these people. And by the way, they're only melanated people anyway, so let's not get all bent out of shape about that. So make no mistake, we are in a life and death battle with white supremacy and its tool of hegemony. In other words, the mechanism that white supremacy uses to control and dominate the entire planet is global capitalism. We have to understand that if we witness this bizarre and brutal slaughter taking place in Gaza, as we witness the destruction and the hijacking of the global attempts to wrestle with what's going to happen if we don't address global warming and climate catastrophe, that it's capitalism that's at the back and at the root of these kinds of events. It's capitalism that's tearing up the continent of Africa. So we must ask ourselves the question, what we going to do? And the emphasis that I want us to hear that question is on the we, what we going to do. In other mm-hmm. words, we cannot be spectators watching these events go by. We have to be very clear that the only way that the kinds of changes that we need, we're going to have to bring that energy ourselves. I listened to a broadcast on Saturday mornings called In Class with Carr, and the principal person who speaks on Saturdays is a professor out of Howard University who developed a framework called Africana Studies. His name is Dr. Greg Carr, and he makes the point all the time, individuals don't beat institutions. I want people to hear that. Individuals do not beat institutions, and we as a people find ourselves in a war with institutionalized power, whether it's the power of corporations, whether it's the power of universities and colleges, whether it's the power of governments, we find ourselves in this death battle, this life and death battle with institutionalized power. And therefore, if we're going to have any chance of success and victory in this equation, we too must operate at an institutional level. So I would say this, and if you're not already a part of an organization, then join one tomorrow, preferably one that has been standing for a while, like an Afrocentric school or church or fraternity, sorority, community organization, and ask them what is their plan to address the powerlessness in black communities. If they can't provide a satisfactory answer to you, then go to our website, usliftingus.com, take a look at our plan and our methodology, and if it makes sense to you, then join with us. And what we're saying, what we're arguing is, A, we must be part of organizations if we're going to have any chance of bringing this American monster and this global racist structure to halt to its knees and to actually break it down, that requires us to have institutions that have the power to stand against this threat. And so we have to be organized on a lot of levels. The thing that is critical, though, is that we find ourselves in a struggle ultimately that's not political, it's economic. It looks political. You know, you have heads of states mm-hmm. making pronouncements and saying policy statements, et cetera, et cetera. That's the politics. But behind those people making those statements and those announcements are economic forces at work. And so the fossil mm-hmm. fuel industry, recognizing that global warming is going to put them out of business, I mean an intelligent response to global warming is going to put them out of business, have doubled down and say they're going to extract every ounce of fossil fuel in the ground, in the air, wherever they find it, they're going to get it because that's how they make their profit and that's how they control the world. So rather than working with governments and with groups of people to say, yeah, global warming is a problem and we have to address it, they're saying, bump all y'all, our profits are more important. And even if it means the end of the planet, we'll have some way of protecting white power as this planet, succumbs to catastrophic climatic events. To build genuine power in a community or a society or a country requires an economic system whereby the people have the means to provide the basics of life, food, clothing, and shelter, energy, etc. In other words, not only do we have to be organized, not only do we have to build institutional power, but most importantly, and this is what I was saying when we began, Sister Q, I think the ancestors mm-hmm. are calling us to build an alternative economy for African people that is an alternative to global capitalism. In other words, it's not just enough that there are some black billionaires, you know, parading around. No shade mm-hmm. on any of them. Happy that they were able to master their art or their craft or their whatever capacity allowed them to become millionaires and billionaires. Fantastic. The reality for the masses of our people here in North America and everywhere we are in the diaspora and most certainly on the African continent is that we have not benefited from a handful of billionaires. In fact, just the opposite is true. By all indices, whether we're talking health, whether we're talking longevity, whether we're talking educational levels, all indications are that we in 2023 are further behind than we were in 1963. So that we're not moving forward. We, in fact, are sliding backward. And I don't know if we have the courage to acknowledge that that is, in fact, what is happening to us as a people. But because of that, now is the opportunity to use our agency and build an alternative economy around the development of cooperative group-owned enterprises. Now, that may sound complicated. I don't know. Call in, let me know what you're hearing. But black people have been involved in alternatives to capitalism since enslavement, you know, since the Civil War and the end of outright enslavement. We hastened to organize mutual aid societies, which then evolved into insurance companies, which then had the capacity to organize banks. We know of Tulsa. We know of Durham, North Carolina, Auburn Avenue in Atlanta. We know of Harlem and places in Baltimore and Philadelphia. So all of these hundreds of cities across the country, black people, because of forced segregation, we had to develop our own economic systems, and we did. And we were able mm-hmm. to exert a level of self-sufficiency that in spite of all the money that's swirling around us in 2023, we don't have that same kind of institutional economic sufficiency. And so two things we want to say. A, we know we've done it before. More importantly, B, we have to do it again. And that's the challenge. With this time, we're not building capitalistic businesses, which are privately owned enterprises, which benefit just a handful of people who are the quote-unquote owners. Now the challenge is to build group-owned, collective cooperatives that can provide food, clothing, shelter, transportation, energy, communication, everything necessary for us to live and to thrive has to be made available to us through these economic institutions that we will build. In most large cities, you will find a Chinatown or a Koreatown or an Indian district or a Vietnamese district, and we should ask mm-hmm. ourselves, why is that? A lot of these groups have integrated fairly well into American society, but yet and still they maintain these economic districts where they operate their own economies. And so we should understand that the reason that that is so is because that is the basis of real power. The reason that our politicians who are in office now don't do what we need them to do is because they are beholden to white groups that have put money into their campaign coffers that enable them to run their advertising campaigns, that enable them to win their seats in their offices. Excuse mm-hmm. me. So now they find themselves when faced, for example, with something like a cop city in Atlanta, which is a quote unquote police training facility, but what really is an urban surveillance and control mechanism for the 21st century. Make no mistake, if people from the Israeli military and secret services are in the United States training urban police departments, what is it do we think that they are telling them and teaching them to do? It's not how to be humane, you know. So the last thing that we need to do is open our cities to these kinds of influences where the policing, which has always been dismal and dangerous, now it will become even more aggressive. More people will die. There will be less freedom. So we don't want to allow these things to unfold in the places where we live. But if we don't have the economic might to push back on that, that's exactly what we'll wind up with. So black people, conscious black people, have realized the trap of seeking liberation through black capitalism since the 1960s. Now the work of this generation, as I said, is to build upon this earlier foundation, cooperative mechanisms, and scale up to global enterprises that can extricate African people from the clutches of capitalism. I know that's a lot of words, so We'll unpack that in a minute. Are there any questions or any comments you would care to make at this point, Sister Q?
There are no hands up on the board, Brother Amti. So I would like for you to continue with your thoughts. I'm finding this very interesting. You are presenting for me a more intense way of looking at some of the things that we see going on. So please continue.
Okay. So we recognize that individuals will never be institutions. So we have to build institutions. That's first and foremost. It makes no sense to start out building political bodies, because we see that with all the work that we've done in the civil rights movement, all the sacrifice and the bloodshed that went into getting the 1965 Voting Rights Bill passed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then watching mm-hmm. that bill become eviscerated in the 2013 Shelby versus Holder versus Shelby Board of Education, Shelby County court decision that went to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court gutted the power portions of that voting rights bill, which was preclearance. In other words, we know from our history that when black people registered to vote, one of the ways or the many ways that we were prevented from being registered was we were told we had to count the number of jelly beans in a jar just by looking at it, or we had to pay some kind of poll tax. All these kinds of schemes were put in place to prevent us from voting, to have the right to vote. And the Civil Rights Act of 1965 said all of that is unconstitutional, it has to stop, and if any changes that are made to voter registration policies must be cleared through the Justice Department before a state can put those policies into action. So from 1965 to 2013, because the opportunities for black people to register and vote were more fair, we were able to exercise a greater amount of voting power that even resulted in, for example, the election of Barack Obama to be the 44th president. White folks seeing that growing political power and also recognizing the demographic shifts that were happening in this country, i.e. A growing population of Hispanic voters, they recognize that, well, you know, the blacks and Hispanics get together, they will exert political power and they will take this country in a very different direction, right? And mm-hmm. so they said, we right. have to okay. break that political power, and they took it to the Supreme Court, and because they had packed the Supreme Court, they came back with the decision in 2013 that told the states they no longer had to pre-clear changes to their registration policies. Now, most of us who vote or are old enough to vote may remember the kinds of changes that were then enacted in city after city after that court decision went down. They said that you had to have a state-approved ID. In other words, all these people that are registered to vote, they're not legal registrants, and so we have to make sure that everybody is a legitimate voter. And so what we experienced in Atlanta, for example, was even though we had valid ID, valid driver's license, everybody had to go in and get a new driver's license. And when you went to get the new driver's license, you had to bring like a birth certificate or a passport of residency, three or four documents. And without those documents, they wouldn't issue this new state driver's license, right? My mother, who was in her late 80s at the time and had been voting all of her life, because she couldn't produce her marriage license, when she got married back in 1920-something, she was not able to get a state-issued ID, right? And people all across the states ran into these problems. It started in South Carolina, Texas. All of the southern states began to put back in place these policies preventing us from voting. Because there was all this voter fraud going on, right? So I'm saying all that simply to say that political power without economic power can be taken back. And that's why we have to think institutional power, and rather than continue to play the game of political power that's not real power, we need to put our energy towards building this economic infrastructure, these economic mm-hmm. institutions that can give us the ability to control our own reality. So not saying that if we won't continue to do political work, we absolutely must. But if we don't at the same time build economic wealth, build economic power, we will always be at the mercy of those who have institutional economic power. Now, here's the good news. To build economic power is actually easier than building political power. In other words, to build political power, you got to get people registered, you got to get them out to vote, you got to protect the vote, you got to go through all these hoops, you got to raise all this money to run campaigns. It's a lot of energy necessary to play the electoral political game. That mm-hmm. same energy, if it was diverted into building cooperative businesses, all you have to do is make the decision, A, I want to be part of an organization that's dedicated to building economic power. B, I am willing to contribute X number of dollars on a monthly basis to generate the capital to open the kinds of businesses that will benefit us. Three, recognizing that capitalism is an exploitative form of economic activity, rather than to exploit our people, we want to launch an alternative system that is cooperative and not competitive. In other words, we want to build an economic system that puts people ahead of profit. We recognize that any viable business is going to generate a surplus. The question is who owns the surplus and how is that surplus redistributed? That's where capitalism is an exploitative system to everybody who is in it, black, white, green, purple, it doesn't matter. If you work on an hourly basis and are paid an hourly wage, you are exploited by capitalism. Now, a lot of folks, labor unions, do not help their members to understand that when they fight to increase their wages, like the auto workers union did just recently, and they pushed through, what, mm-hmm. a 25, 35% increase? Well, two things are going to happen. It seems like the major owners of General Motors and Stellantis and Ford, out of the goodness of their hearts, agreed that they would pay their workers more money. Mm-hmm. That's the version that the newspapers present to us. The question that we have to ask is, where does that extra money come from? Well, it has to come right from the profit. True. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the argument might be made, well, now that, you know, they've taken money from the profits, that those businesses won't have the same strength and capacity to grow, and that's going to ultimately hurt the economy. The question that they're not asking is, where did the profit come from in the first place? It didn't fall out of the sky. The profit was made or created or generated by the energy that the workers exert every hour on the hour for the 40 or 50 hours that they're there in the plant each week. In other words,
mm-hmm.
all of the revenue generated by the business comes from the work done by the workers. So the workers have just as much right to the profit as the owners do. But they don't think like that. They say, okay, well, the CEO made $4 million last year. If they can pay the CEOs and these executives this kind of money, surely they can pay the workers a living wage, right? The question needs to be asked is, if we the workers have created this profit, this surplus, then we should be the ones that make the decision on how much of it goes where and who gets what. Under capitalism, you don't have that conversation. And that's the problem.
Right.
You created the wealth,
right,
but the owners stole it and paid you peanuts on the dollar for your work. So we in Us Lifting Us, when we talk about building group-owned, collective, cooperative businesses, in our model, all the workers, all the consumers, the community institutions, the community organizations, everybody is a co-owner in this business, in this business project. So as the surplus is generated, rather than paying the CEO a multi-million dollar annual salary, we look at all of the surplus that's generated, and we bring it back to say, well, we need effective school systems. We need an African-centered school system to so our children have a healthy sense of who they are, what they've accomplished, and what they can be. We need a healthcare system that recognizes that our bodies are different. Our metabolism is different. Our DNA is different. We need a health policies that work for us, and so that we can have a higher level of well-being and health than what we're currently experiencing. And because we've done this work, so in addition to the workers being paid a weekly salary, getting a weekly paycheck, on a quarterly basis they would also get a dividend from their ownership and their membership in the co-op that owned the business. And that dividend would be larger than the weekly monies that they got paid, because that would be also a portion of the surplus that is generated by the business. What I hope people are hearing in this conversation is a different way of understanding the purpose and the role of what an economic system is supposed to accomplish for the people who participate in it. This idea that the profits belong to the shareholders and that the company can do business in a community in a way that is destructive of the water in the community, of the ground soil in the community, that the workers can be paid a fraction of what they've generated, and that's okay, and the CEOs and the upper management can walk out of there with $10 and $15 million a year in bonuses, while the people who are doing the work week to week can barely pay their bills. That is absurd, but that is the system that we have been immersed in, and told that this is the best system, this is the best economic model on the planet that has ever existed. Not true. Not true.
Right.
And it's this system that is destroying the planet as we speak. The fossil fuel industry, because from fossil fuels, we also get agribusiness, because those fossil fuels wind up in the fertilizers. They wind up in the weed killers. They wind up in the pharmaceutical industry. All these pills that are being prescribed are derivatives of the petrochemicals. So that the fossil fuel industry drives 90% of the American economy, of the global economy. And that is why they are reluctant to relinquish it in search of a sustainable future based on renewable energy. The main reason is that, because you think about it, if the sun can be converted into electricity, then it's hard for them to control the sun. I mean, every morning we wake up, the sun is shining. So if you have a solar panel or the means to capture that sunlight and a mechanism that can convert it into electricity, you don't have to pay Georgia Power or North Carolina Power or any of these power companies for your electricity. So one of the reasons they've been stalling to move to renewable energy is because they want to capture the sun in such a way that you and I still have to pay these utility companies for electric energy, right?
Yeah.
And even though they know nuclear energy, that's the transition source that gets us from fossil fuel to renewable, right? They have never had the conversation about, yeah, but the byproduct of the nuclear power plant is this spent uranium tubes and rods, and they have a shelf life of 235 light years. In other words, these rods will be dangerous 10 generations from now, 20 generations from now, and you have no place to store them. You know, if you store them in the ground, they leak. If the war breaks out, the plant can be compromised. Nuclear energy is extremely dangerous as a form of providing energy and electricity. But to build a nuclear plant is a multi-billion dollar investment. So they love that, because these multi-billion dollar building projects makes a lot of people very rich. Right?
Exactly.
So, again, that's fossil fuel determining the kind of world that we live in without us even having a say in the conversation. Is this what the kind of future that we want for ourselves and our children? So that's the dangers of capitalism. I mean, we could spend the next 5 years talking about that. But suffice it to say that the kind of cooperative model that we're building, because all of the people who are involved in the community are owners of the enterprise, everyone has a say in how the enterprise is run, and everyone gets dividends and results from the surplus that our collective energy creates. Does that make sense?
Right.
And so it really is imperative that we take seriously the building of these kinds of economic institutions, you know, as some people would say, right now. You know, we don't need to wait another further. There's nothing to wait for. Now, again, part of the good news is that we can start pooling our resources and generating sufficient capital to open businesses very quickly. This is not something that takes eons to do. The money is flowing through our hands. It's just a question of whether or not we have, I hate to use this term, but we have the will to say, you know, it is in our interest to form our own economic enterprises, and we must do this.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of schemes have been put out there. I mean, this is not, we're not sharing anything new tonight. What we are asking our listeners to give even more serious consideration to is, okay, if we make the decision to, on a monthly basis, to subscribe $25, $50, $100, whatever makes sense for your budget, and we pull enough people into this process, well, then we can put on a graph and plot it out. Well, in 2 years, we can open this kind of business. In 3 years, we can do this. In 4 years, we can do that. In 5 years, we can do X, Y, and Z. We've got 7 years before we start seeing really disastrous impacts from global warming. So this is, the clock is running. This is not something we can sit around and analyze to death. This is something that we need to be moving on right away. I do now want to shift our conversation to talking specifically about Us Lifting Us and the Us Lifting Us base communities. Sister Q, so are there any questions or any, how are we doing on time right now?
We have 15 minutes to go, and we have no hands up, so you are free to do what you do.
Thank you.
You're good.
Us Lifting Us represents a collective effort to coordinate the wisdom, the collective wisdom of our people in the work that we've done to bring us to this stage. There's a fascinating book by, hold on a second, Jessica Nembhard, called Collective Courage. Jessica Nembhard, Collective Courage. If you don't have that, I would encourage you to pick it up. It's a history, it's a chronology of Black people's work in building cooperatives. As I said earlier, from the end of enslavement up through 2000. And it talks about mm-hmm. all the various organizations and forms that we've done. And what it makes us aware of is that a serious or a sizable segment of our community has recognized the need to do this for as long as we've been here. Interestingly mm-hmm. enough, many of the ideas that show up in Collective Courage, they trace their roots back to the African continent. In other words, African people have been engaged in economic activity since the first communities, because when we talk about an economy, all we're talking about is the system that a group of people use to produce and distribute the goods and services that they need to sustain their lives. It's not complicated.
Mm-hmm.
People need right. food. People need clothing. People need shelter. People need energy. People need communication. They need transportation. They need education for their children. They need health care. They may need elder care. But the system that allows them to produce what they need and distribute it, all of these goods and services, whether we're talking about a doctor or whether we're talking about an automobile, how people go about doing that is their economy. If you mm-hmm. want to understand it, just as I mentioned when I talk about Chinatown or Vietnamese town or Koreatown or the Indian communities, just go into mm-hmm. those places where they set up and watch them do what they do. Invariably, they're not selling the same stuff you see in your Kroger or your Publix. They're selling the foods that they right. like to eat. So you always get a different mm-hmm. variety of vegetables and fruits. Whatever they need, they like to wear their traditional clothing. So you're going to see clothing based on their culture. And mm-hmm. as rich as Black and African culture is, there should be flourishing Black towns in every major city where we live. These are opportunities for us to take a hard look at how do we feed ourselves? How do we clothe ourselves? We were talking in a meeting, and Baba Hekima mentioned that one of the things that Dr. John Henry Clark had asked in a group he was talking to, this is going way back,
mm-hmm.
he chided us because he says, we don't even make the underwear we wear, you know, and we have not thought about how do we begin to behave as a sovereign people, as a liberated people? And when we start mm-hmm. thinking about what are our needs and how do we meet those needs amongst ourselves, it's a very liberating way of looking at the reality that we're living in. Instead of being so quick to run to other people for those basics of life, let's think in terms of let's do this for ourselves. Let's call upon our own genius and our own collective wisdom and put together systems that can produce these goods for ourselves. So the Ulu base community is just that. It's the initial formation of a group anywhere from 12 to 25 people who come together and say, we want to be economically empowered and begin to have a say-so in the way that we live, in the places where we live. The other reason why the cooperative model is so important to our people at this juncture in our history goes back to something Amilcar Cabral wrote about in his book, Revolution in Guinea. And the point that he was making in an essay called The Weapon of Theory was that until people regain control over the means of production, they are not able to make history. They are participating in someone else's history making, someone else's narrative. It is only when we control the means of production ourselves that we return ourselves to being makers of our own history. Now, I don't know how that hits people's ears, but it challenges us if we're serious about being women and men, fully mature, activating and operating in our own agency, we simply must regain control over the means of production, which is the land, the labor, the capital, the technology, the tools, all of that. The exciting thing about building a cooperative is that nobody can stop us, and as these cooperatives grow, they are the new means of production. So we have the capacity tonight, Sister Q, to build or rebuild our own means of production, and nobody can stop us. We don't have to ask President Biden, is this okay? We don't have to call the senator or the city council president or the mayor or the good pastor. All we have to do is come together in these organizations and say that we are going to pool our resources, generate the capital, and open a cooperative business, just like we have always done when we decided to do that. Each business then becomes an aspect of our owning means of production. And that's why it's such a well-kept secret. People do not want us to understand what we are taking control of in with this kind of behavior. But this is self-directed thought of how people who understand that we are sovereign beings on this planet, created in the image of the Creator, and we have license to do this because that's what it means to be human. And so for us to continue to participate in an economic system that holds us at the bottom and exploits our labor, that's not what self-determining people do. Self-determining people say, we're going to build our own businesses, but we're going to own them collectively, cooperatively, and we're going to produce what we need to survive. We're not going to allow our future to be left in the hands of people who have said in no uncertain terms they do not like us. And so the Us Lifting Us-based communities begin with a small group, as I said, of 12 to 25 people who come together and say, we are going to become a base community in this city. Now, each city, I mean, there can be hundreds of these base communities. There's no limit to that. And they're going to grow in size from, you know, the initial 25 to around 100 and 125 maybe. But each base community, the members will subscribe and pay on a monthly basis a certain amount of money, whether it's $10 a month or $25 a month, $50 a month, $100 a month, whatever they're comfortable doing. But they're going to do it consistently over time. And as we generate this initial startup capital and begin to open cooperative businesses, small scale, medium scale, large scale, as the businesses become viable and able to generate surplus, then the businesses will renew themselves. We won't have to continue to subscribe to generate the startup capital. We will have primed the pump, and the system can run on its own. So we're talking an effort that, you know, might take us 1 to 5 years, but once we get it up and running, it is self-sustaining and self-renewing. And, you know, if people want to see an example of what this might look like, then I encourage them to Google Mondragon cooperatives in northern Spain and see how 6 workers in 1956 started a tool making factory, I think it was, and 20 years later that one cooperative business had grown to more than 200 cooperative businesses, and they were generating in excess of $24 billion a year in 20 years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And employing 80,000 plus workers. Now, that was just a worker cooperative. What ULU is putting together is a combination of workers and consumers and community institutions, churches and community organizations, so that every aspect of our community is a stakeholder in this collectively owned business, so that we will look a little different than Mondragon. But the principle is the same. We will have pooled our resources, started businesses that are cooperatives, and that they in turn will grow to become these juggernauts, these economic juggernauts that can employ hundreds and thousands, hundreds of thousands of our people. And and generating the kind of annual surplus that enables us to transform the places where we live. And the most exciting part of that is we're not asking anybody to be a part of this who is outside of our community. This is our initiative. It's for our people. It's for our children. And it's well within our capacity to do this if we decide that, or rather, when we decide that it's time. And I'm just saying that given all that's going on in the world, it's clear, A, nobody is going to come to help us when the stuff hits the fan. And B, no one has a better vision of what it is that we need and how we want to move in the world than we do. So this is on us to do, and we're doing it. People go to our website. Check us out and hit the join tab and be part of this movement.
Brother Umpty, we have a hand up, so I'm going to take this call.
Okay.
Before we go, calling with the last 4 digits 8912. Please state your name, where you're calling from, make your comment or ask your question.
Yes, this is Brother Thurman, us Lifting Us member, and I want to give big thanks to Brother Unky for what you brought us tonight and what you always bring us, and Sister Q doing the same kind of powerful work. And I just want to remind the family that going right along with everything you've talked about tonight, Brother Unky, is there's a post that's on the Us Lifting Us Facebook page by Brother Kiti Awadu that's been teaching natural health for 40 years. And we're being attacked in every subject area, and every subject area we must, make our own moves, be on the right, on the black side of the chessboard, and counter their moves to keep them from checkmating us, including the diet. And Brother Kiti got a post, a post that's on the Us Lifting Us Economic Facebook page that says, don't boycott Xmas, boycott pointless consumerism. And it's a call that he did a few days ago, but it's available and you can click on the link. And it says, what are we going to do about Xmas? So often we are told to boycott holiday shopping or support Buy Black campaigns, yet do we need to be spending consumer dollars when there are so many pressing issues affecting our members, our people? And we shouldn't. And I just want to just put that out there and encourage the Ulu family to not to hurry and buy more stuff, but to put a stop to the consumerism and including all of the European holidays. And if we don't, we're just doing an injustice, a continuous injustice to ourselves and our ancestors that did a lot to fight and to serve and even die to open up the way for us to be free again. And also on our Facebook page, there's a full documentary about how China got rich. We need to check those things out, take a stroll through our mind, and want to get free and stop this reckless consumerism. Thank you so much, family.
Thank you for the comment, Brother Thurman.
Ashe.
Brother Anki, anything else you want to say?
I just want to say thanks to Brother Thurman for the comment. I want to thank Brother Thurman for the comment right on time, as always. And thank you, Sister Q, for helming the program tonight. Excellent job, as always. And thank our listeners for tuning in and being with us. We ask for you to give us some feedback and to join us. As we form these collectives and open cooperative businesses, that's the path forward to our victory.
Thank you for that, Brother Anki. We want to invite everyone to join us again next Thursday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for another installment of Dare to Win. Peace.
Take us out with some music, Sister Q.
I can't get the music. My computer is doing something crazy. It put up another screen on top of what I was doing, and I can't get back to my own screen.
Okay.
So it looks like I'm going to have to just shut the program down because the whole music side is covered up, and the only side I could see is like stop the program.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. So thank everyone for joining us tonight, and we will be back next Thursday night. Peace.
Peace, sister.